start with a prayer. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever.
Amen.
Heavenly King, Consoler, Spirit of Truth, present in all places and filling all things, the treasury of blessings and the giver of life, come and dwell in us, cleanse us of all stain, and save our souls, O good one. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, forever and ever.
Amen.
Good evening. I'm Father Elias. This is my wife. Yes, my wife, Sylvia. I am married, and I am Catholic, and I am a priest. Don't run out. As you have either learned or will learn in our CIA, the Catholic Church is a communion of 24 sui juris, or self-governing churches. The largest of those 24 is the Latin Church. It's also the only church in the West. The other 23 self-governing churches are all Eastern churches in union with Rome. We happen to belong to a Melkite Greek Catholic Church, so it's the See of Antioch, where they were first called Christians. And our parish is just down the road at Holy Transfiguration. Many years ago, we attended here as Roman Catholics. And Scott was brave enough, kind enough, or crazy enough to ask us to come and teach on marriage. We have a few kids, and we've been married a few years. And we've been doing it for, we were trying to figure out on the way here tonight how long we've been doing this.
Many years.
Okay.
I can't keep track.
It's more than a decade.
You've been doing it as long as I've been coordinating it, and maybe longer.
And that has been?
I'd have to look it up, but it's got to be at least, it's probably 10 years now.
So we have not succeeded in being uninvited back. So hopefully we will keep that streak tonight. So we're going to talk about the Catholic teaching on marriage. And the way I would like to phrase this is an ideal and a vision that we all strive towards. I don't know everyone's background. I don't know everyone's state of catechesis. So we may say some things tonight to you that are surprising or shocking that you may disagree with. It's a class. Feel free. Raise your hand. Ask questions. It's much more fun. Audience participation. One question. Where are you all coming from in terms of your faith backgrounds?
He's sitting there.
And what are your names?
My name's Brian.
I'm Brian.
Hi, Brian.
I'm married with four kids.
Oh, yeah.
That's why my wife isn't here. They just had another baby.
Congratulations.
Wow.
I grew up non-denominational, but since then I've been kind of going up the ladder through the other denominations, so.
Yes.
Are you an Episcopalian or a Methodist right now?
We were an Anglican for quite a while.
Okay. My name's Josh. I come from an evangelical background and stopped attending church or studying the Bible late teens, all throughout my 20s. Got divorced in my mid-30s and did some soul-searching and really thought it was probably God and spirituality that was missing in my marriage. And I have a 9-year-old son and didn't bring him up. So that's what led me to the path of inquiry, and that's how I ended up here.
Yeah. So Brian and
Josh. Yeah.
So I'm David. Grew up as Baptist and Methodist. Mom was Baptist, dad was Methodist, so we jumped back and forth throughout the day going to two services.
Yeah.
Dad was a farmer helper hand. I got tired, so we quit going to church and went to church later on. Then life does what it does sometimes. Fell out, and then now trying to figure out what religion am I? Like, am I Baptist what my parents had? Or do you like the Catholic religion? I told someone at work, kind of mad. I was like, I like Catholics because it's not just Sunday Baptist service at 11 o'clock and then you're not doing anything, so there's a chance to worship all throughout the week. So that's what brings me here.
Come on, there's Bible study on Wednesday night.
Not back home.
Oh, really? All right. Okay.
Do they have a Bible study on Wednesday? Is it practice?
Oh, I don't know.
Oh,
usually at Baptist churches, there's a Wednesday night Bible study as well.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
My dad runs the Wednesday night Bible study at his church.
See,
I haven't been able to reel him in to the
he's coming.
One Holy Catholic and Apostolic Church yet.
He's coming. Everything else is falling apart. In the Bible.
We wrote the Bible.
Yeah.
That's why I'm here.
Well, my name's Ken.
Hold on, he's going behind you first.
Oh,
you didn't see that I was pointing to him.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I fit in more after him, so I'm not.
As you wish.
My name is Kent.
Hi,
I grew up in Bible churches. I think they would be predominantly Calvinist, like 5-point Calvinist churches.
Tulip.
Yeah. And Mary, or just got married actually last March. I don't know why that was funny. March, and then we got married outside the church. And March, she's Catholic. And then we got our marriage invalidated in in November, very recently. And a lot of arguments about, you know, my ignorant beginning of, like, where is that in the Bible, those kind of questions that you hear from Protestants all the time.
Good questions.
Kind of just working through all those objections that I have significantly less objections than I did when I started, and I'm just working through that process right now, which is why I'm in this room. So, yeah.
Yeah.
That's my story.
Stick to it.
My name is James. I was raised Methodist. I am a friend of Ken's, and as Ken has worked through his objections, we have been talking about his objections. And, you know, he mentioned that he was going to RCIA, and he finally convinced / I decided that it was time to join him. Kirsten and coming to Mass for the first time yesterday, and coming to RCIA for the first time today, and so here I am. And,
are you still wet back here? Right on, we're glad you're here. You made the first important step, good job. And you, Kirsten?
Yep.
Kirsten or Kirsten?
Yep, I'm the Catholic.
Kirsten.
Yep.
Very good.
Just here, because honestly, well, when he started asking me all these hard questions, I was like, I'm like running down the hall to my mom, like, Mom, did you know the rosary is not in the Bible? Like, what? Why do we believe what we believe? Like, and I'm the cradle Catholic, so I don't know how to defend my faith. I, you know, went to Catholic school, but I didn't go to Catholic school in high school, and that's when they did a lot of, like, you know, learning how to defend your faith and stuff. So, kind of picking up where I left off after, like, confirmation, I guess.
I think this type of thing needs to be required for adults, because you have to do it when you're a kid so you don't listen. But once you've been out in the world and realize, I really don't know anything, it is nice to have some place to go and get some answers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Truly. Truly, truly.
Marriage is what brings us together today. Princess Bride, anyone?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Believe it or not, I have never seen that.
Oh.
But it's in my queue, and Melissa's going to make me watch it before too long.
It's very cool.
I don't know how I've avoided it. It's like it's like somehow I just missed that piece of pop culture.
Society will make more sense after this.
I know. Yeah, all these references to marriage are going to suddenly start making sense.
Ooh, this is even a Princess Bride reference.
That's right. I'm not a witch, I'm your wife. Did you see that? The magnet that they have. Anyway, okay, we digress.
We totally digress.
Okay, so.
Are we going to start with that skit?
Yes, we are.
Really?
Are
we
you
have
ready?
To?
Yes, we are. Here we go. Ready? It goes like this. Adam. Adam!
Yeah.
Adam!
What?
There's a monster over there!
Yes, or what?
Do something, Adam!
Okay, I'm going to go have a beer.
Adam, he's dragging me away!
All right, I'll be back. This is one view of marriage, and this is our rendition of what happened in the garden. Right? Says a snake, the word in the Bible is actually indicates a dragon or beast, right? So it's the failure of Adam to act as he was supposed to be.
And the way it's supposed to be is, Adam!
Yes!
Adam!
Oh,
there's a monster!
Get away! Get away! Okay.
Gift of self.
Gift of self. Sacrificial.
Sacrificial.
Right, because the implication of the scene with Adam, Eve, and the serpent, if you notice, she turns to Adam. He's right there during the whole exchange. And the underlying implication, the way Scott Hahn explains this, is that Adam was afraid for himself. And so he didn't intervene in the conversation that was happening. And when we talk about marriage tonight, one of the things we're going to talk about, something very popular, is the role of husbands and wives, because they're different. And marriage works when the husband lives up to his role, which is self-sacrificing love for his spouse. Because husbands in marriage are in the image of Christ. If you read St. Paul in Ephesians chapter 5, and in our tradition, the nudge verse is read in every single wedding service where it says, husbands, love your wives, wives, be submissive. But it talks about the image of Christ representing the church and the bride, Christ represent, the husband representing Christ and the bride representing the church. So one of the things we want to try to communicate tonight is that marriage is really about learning to grow in self-sacrificing love. So people have a lot of different ideas about marriage. People get married for different reasons. And we know that the divorce rate is probably over 50% right now. Among Catholics as well as non-believers, with one very small demographic we're going to talk about, where the divorce rate is, I think, what, 2 or
3%?
Yep. But we'll get there in a few minutes. So is that our last kid?
Yeah. You're over here next.
Oh, am I? Okay. Yes. So are we going to read from the catechism?
Well, you could do that first.
We need a volunteer. How about, I'll talk about that if you find a volunteer.
Okay. Well, I feel like I can just go right around the room.
Okay, and we can have one to share.
Yeah, I want Kirsten to go first. Then you can fall asleep after this.
Okay.
You got to go last with the introduction. So.
That's right. That's right.
It's easy to go first.
Is it?
Okay, we'll just
you don't have to wait.
All right. So if you have never opened up your catechism before, it's arranged by subject and it has paragraph numbers. So we'll throw out a number and you just go in numerical order until you find 1604, and you'll find that in the section about marriage. It may surprise you.
This is actually a tremendous resource for the Christian faith in general, the Catholic faith in particular. So we highly encourage you, everyone, to have one in their home.
Let's start with 1601 instead of 1604.
Yes, ma'am. That's
we didn't do. Okay, I'm sorry. Kirsten, can we do 1601 instead of 1604?
Yeah, because it's shorter. So.
There you go. I feel better about it already.
All right. Am I reading it?
Yes. Out loud, even. Please.
Okay. The matrimonial covenant by which a man and a woman establish between themselves a partnership of the whole of life is by its nature ordered toward the good of the spouses and the procreation and education of offspring. This covenant between baptized persons has been raised by Christ the Lord to the dignity of a sacrament.
So I'm just going to comment on a few things, and then Sylvia's going to talk about covenant versus contract. The whole of life, right, ordered by nature toward the good of the spouses. The ultimate good of the spouses is the ultimate good of any human being is salvation. So a lot of times there's this like thought in our head that like being a Christian and being a Catholic is like this two-tiered thing. So there's like the priests, the religious, the nuns, the monks, like the professionals, and then there's the rest of us, right? We just kind of schlep along. But marriage is equally holy as is religious life, right, as is priestly life. And so marriage is designed by God to help you towards salvation, right? Not just escaping hell, but growing into the fullness of the image and likeness of Christ. So think about marriage as that place where you learn to really live as a Christian through effort, day in and day out.
So just some clarification on some words here. We have covenant versus contract. Anyone want to stab at which one means what and why we have two different words? Stab. Who will stab?
Contracts are more like obligations that are fulfilled for like the good or some sort of thing.
Like goods or services?
Yeah.
I'm going to use the word things, exactly.
Things.
So contracts are for things, and covenants are between people. They're agreements between people. So if you were to take a wild guess, which one of these better fits marriage? Is it a marriage contract or is it a marriage covenant? Exactly. Covenant, exactly. Because we're talking about people and relationships.
And also in covenants, too, like that language is used throughout the Old Testament, right? God makes covenants. Well, with a covenant, people who are not related become related, right? So this is another reason why we call it the marriage covenant, because these two unrelated people, hopefully unrelated, are related now down to the sacrament of marriage.
What's the church's stance on consanguinity?
That depends on the degree of closeness.
Because I know first cousins is like.
And this.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a loaded question.
Yeah, so, we're Melkites, and most of our people come to the Middle East, and I'm going to stop there.
Okay.
Yeah, and I can go any further. There may be places where the Melkites came in and overthrew the Greek Orthodox because the Greeks said no, and the Melkites said yes. But again, we're not going to talk about that. There's certain degrees that are okay, far enough out. First cousins.
at least first to get.
Yeah. I'm Puerto Rican, so I gotta ask.
Well,
I completely understand. And one of the things I'm gonna put out there, if anything we say tonight like bothers you, disturbs you, you go, talk to your priest. Right? Because there's a difference between dogmatic theology and pastoral theology. Right? What we're giving you is the ideal that we strive towards. And there are times where people are in various circumstances in their life, and it's like, okay, this isn't really my experience, and I'm kind of worried. Go talk to your priest and help you work it out. A few things I want to say real quick. The idea of being a gift to the spouse, right? John Paul II, in his Theology of the Body, he talks a lot about the law of the gift, right? And that's one way to read the Genesis account. Adam and Eve were created emotionally, spiritually, and psychologically to be a complete gift of self, one to the other. When we enter into marriage and we hold back from our spouse, we don't give ourselves fully to our spouse, we are stunting our own spiritual, emotional, and psychological growth, as well as that of our spouse, and harming our marriages. The other thing I wanted to say is that marriage is about mutual martyrdom. When we hear the words martyrdom, we misunderstand it. We think about people being thrown to the lions, or their heads chopped off. And its ultimate meaning, a martyr is a witness, right? So marriage is where you learn to be a witness to the world of the love of Christ by living out your marriage alone. Over to you.
Ken, 1604.
She was 1601, right?
Yep, you're 1604.
Yes, sir.
Got it. All right. God, who created man out of love, also calls him to love, the fundamental and innate vocation of every human being. For man is created in the image and likeness of God, who is himself love. Since God created him, man and woman, their mutual love becomes an image of the absolute and unfailing love with which God loves man. It is good, very good, in the Creator's eyes. And this love, which God blesses, is intended to be fruitful and to be realized in the common work of watching over creation. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it.
Good. So we have a list of what marriage is according to the Catholic Church. Number one, it requires something. And anyone who can read can tell me what it requires.
Baptism.
Baptism. It's marriage is an action that happens between two baptized people. And its purpose... Yes, go ahead.
Just to be really clear, like, you can not be Catholic and be baptized and get married. We consider that a marriage, but we're talking about a sacramental marriage within the context of the Catholic Church. Okay, over back to you. Sorry.
That's the fine print at the bottom.
I can't help it.
The purpose is not just sex, money, power. It's the good of each other, specifically this good right here. The whole goal is to get each other to heaven. It's also to have children, if you can, physically have children, and educating them. I was at a cemetery, like, I don't know, 3 months ago, and a man was burying his wife, and she wasn't even that old. I mean, it was one of those heart-wrenching things where all the children are gathered around their mother's casket. And I watched him walk back to his car alone after having put his wife in the ground. And instead of the sense of, oh my gosh, how could this happen? There was suddenly like this awareness of, oh my word, that one thing that marriage is for, getting your spouse to heaven, he had accomplished that with a huge check mark. That was so done. They were a beautiful Catholic couple who loved God and kept his commandments and really gave a beautiful witness. And it was beautiful to see this action having been done. It really took a lot of the melancholy out of it. Anyhow, I digress.
One comment on the paragraph that Ken, just by word on the board, just read. Love, right? We're going to talk about love a lot tonight. Our culture doesn't understand love as we mean it as Christians. When we talk about love, especially in the context of marriage, it's not the butterflies you feel. It's not warm feelings. It's an act of the will. And I like to point people to 1 Corinthians chapter 13, where Paul says, love is patient, love is kind. Take your name, stick it in there, turn it into a question, and you'll know if you're loving or not. So love is an act of the will, and it requires effort, and it doesn't, Christian love does not come naturally. And love is what comes, you know, after the babies, after the diapers, right? It develops over time. So at the end of your marriage, you look back and you say, yeah, we love each other. Right? It grows with time. Sorry. Back to you.
So, how do we...
Do you want to do the triangle first?
No, you do the triangle.
Oh,
please.
That came before the...
Yeah, so, okay.
You're throwing us off.
All right.
So, it's We wanted to talk about marriage as a living icon for the world to see of the God who is Trinity. Right? God is a communion of persons. Right? He's not just one. Right? He is one, but there's three persons. Right? Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. So the couple shows the plurality in God. And in a way, right, it's a very loose analogy, but just in terms of how there is the Trinity, right? You have a husband, you have a wife, and then three children come along. So love is always fruitful. Love is always communal in its fullest sense. Okay, back to you.
Good.
Sorry
okay.
for interrupting.
Now, how do we know that we're supposed to get married? And if we think we're supposed to get married, how do we know how to find the right person? Whew, there are websites devoted to this. First thing, what's the very first thing we got to do when we're doing anything major in our life?
Pray.
Well done. Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Josh gets
next
vegetable.
Year we need to bring candy.
Okay, yeah. Prayer. So prayer comes number one. What are we praying for? What types of things are we praying for?
Opportunity.
Okay, someone to marry. Specifically. All right. What else do we want in a spouse?
Virtues. Good virtues.
Yeah. That may be some commonality. Some things that you do together, that you've experienced together. All of those things. The other question is, am I called to marriage? What are some of the other things we can do besides get married with our lives?
Priests.
Yes, good, okay. Yep. What else? What else can we do? What else can we do besides get, be a priest or get married? Is it possible to live without getting married? Yeah. So you could be a single person, in which case we would call that celibate. What does celibate mean? Yeah. Celibate means you agree not to have sex. So here's the thing, and I'll just... This is early. I'm going to throw you off again. I'm sorry. Same-sex attraction. It is a thing that people of the same gender are attracted to one another. Not everybody, but some people have it. It seems that we can't control it. And the question is, does the Catholic Church hate people like that? Do we want people who are homosexual or have homosexual inclinations, do we want them to not be around and, like, we never talk to them and we put them over on the east side of Washington, D.C.? No, exactly. We don't. And the deal is that if you have a same-sex attraction, the church asks you to be celibate. It's a huge cross. But so is being pregnant. Right? I mean, like, we all have these things. Like, some people go with heart conditions and have to have their valves replaced, and that's an enormous cross to carry. And in the same way, the cross of having the same-sex attraction and being asked to remain celibate is a terribly difficult thing, but not impossible, especially if you have the grace of God. So you got to do a lot of this, and you got to do a lot of hanging around with people who will support you and encourage you in your remaining celibate. It's hard, but it is possible. Because God does not hate gay people, and neither does the Catholic Church.
Can I jump in on that just for a second?
Well, careful.
Okay. I like the word chastity better than celibacy, because chastity implies self-control. And in our particular tradition, the prayers of the marriage service include calls for marital chastity. Now, you guys are wondering, well, what do you mean chastity if we're getting married? Because marriage is not a free-for-all, and the spouses are not objects. Chastity means self-control and integrity. Part of the challenge with our culture today, both with the Latin discipline of priestly celibacy and same-sex attracted people who are called to live a celibate life, our culture will tell you that, well, that's not possible. It is possible, because we're not animals, and we do have self-control. So just, again, raising that vision of who we are as human beings, right? Our sexual faculties are given to us so that we can enter into communion with a lifelong spouse of the opposite gender. And if we cannot, then we redirect those energies and those desires to something else. Sorry, back to you.
I want to put something in on that. The sexual attraction is super important to unify you as a couple during those first really difficult years.
First 10 to 12 years are the worst.
Especially when you have little children. Like, those are hard years. And so the sexual attraction, the attraction to the person's physicality,
Those are really important for helping you to establish a relationship that's going to last. For how long are we going on now?
This will be 30.
This is 30.
Babies and bonding.
Been a lot of years.
Okay. What are we doing next?
I forgot. Okay, I think there's a scripture quote coming up.
We can read from Faith Explained. Yes.
Okay, we're skipping
5:20?
Yes.
You have the book, right?
Don't
tell me. James. It's James's turn to read. Got that one. So he didn't say, we have 10 children. So I'm working on learning people's names and trying to hold them in my brain. Sometimes my kids will be like, oh, Mom, because I run through everyone, and including the dog's names, and then I finally have to say, you know I'm talking to you. Don't pretend that you don't know who I'm speaking to. But I call them George and Uncle and Jimmy and Bob. And yes. 5:20?
Yes. Hang on 1 second. Okay.
It used to be in this class that everyone got a copy of this book and brought it to class at the time.
They all have a copy.
Oh, good.
Except the new people who don't have the books yet.
Okay.
Who's our
leader? We're with James in the back there. Thank you.
Did we move all the way?
We're calling him James the First because it's the first time that he's come. The first time he went to Mass.
From here down to,
so the wise person who feels that marriage is his or her vocation, what are some of the elementary steps in the choice of a lay partner? The most basic precaution, obviously, is to choose a Catholic partner, a husband and wife who cannot kneel at the altar and receive the Blessed Sacrament together, who cannot live by a shared set of moral principles, who cannot pray the same prayers together with their children, begin their married life under a terrific handicap. And the only way for a person to make sure of marrying a Catholic is, of course, to have dates with none but Catholic companions.
Thank you.
Do you want to jump in or have them read the next one?
No. Let's do the compatibility story first.
Okay. Thank you.
There was once a time when cell phones did not exist. Some of you understand that because we're from the same era, but it's hard for other people to understand that there was once a time when either cell phones weighed 4 pounds and you carried them around like this with a big handle.
Use them for self-defense if you need to.
That's right. Secondary usage. But in the days before cell phones existed, Father Elias here asked me to marry him. I was like, well, we're just really not compatible. You know, because there were differences. And I was like,
I was a Navy guy from California, New England, blah, blah.
I was from a New England family, and it just, you know, things were different. So I was like, I don't think this is going to work. And so one day we're driving to his mother's church in downtown San Francisco.
My mom's not Catholic.
This is a storefront church in an area of town that I would not go without an escort.
Nor I.
Okay. So we're pulling up to the church. He's like, you know, we could just get married. And I'm like, we're not compatible. And we get out together and go in to his mother's church. And up at the front of the church is a woman called the mother of the church. Store that aside for future reference. The mother of the church was the mother of the pastor. And she's standing up at the front like this, Bible in one hand, microphone in the other. And it was her job before the service started to teach the women. So she's teaching the women and teaching them along, and I walk in, and you know I'm the only little white face in there, so I'm kind of like going behind the pillar to sit down behind the pillar, and she goes, honey, please God, don't mind if you're talking to me. She goes, honey, come up here.
And I'm like, I'm so dead.
So I walk to the front of this church. Hi. She says, I don't know who you are, and I don't know who you came here with, but I want you to know you're perfectly compatible. At which point, I thought that the Holy Spirit might have something to do with what was going on. Okay, now we need 5:18. Will you read that one too? Who's got it?
Does James still have it?
No.
Oh, you took it away. Okay.
518 or 519?
I don't know. I can't read anymore. 519, yes.
Okay, thank you.
I am looking at how small that font is. I'm like, how are you guys reading
this? You know what? I did not double check it. I don't print things in like 12 font. 12 point.
Yes.
That's like 6 or something.
Yes.
Thank you for saying
Google
that. So
Doc,
I didn't
Microsoft
have
Word, and then out the door. So, who's our next volunteer?
I think you're with Josh now.
Okay, Josh. All right. If you wouldn't mind reading, I think it's this part right here, just down to where it ends with children.
It is a sad but observable fact that people sometimes will exercise more care in choosing a car or coat than they will exercise in choosing a husband or wife. In spite of the fact that this is a lifelong, unbreakable union, for better or for worse, into which they are entering. More than that, it is a vocation which they are choosing, a state of life upon which will depend their own salvation and that of their children.
So, marriage isn't something that we just sort of like stumble into. You know, one example the book goes on to cite is someone who is discerning a vocation to the acolyte or to the priesthood, right? It takes time. I met this guy last week, I met this gal last month. I think they're fun, so we're going to just get married and we'll just try it on for size. If it doesn't work, we'll just get a divorce. Right? So, this idea, right, is that you have to remember the person you're marrying is the person, or the means by which you're going to get to heaven, right? So we don't believe in try before you buy. So one of my sons said to me as I was getting ready for the talk, he's like, what do you guys talk about? And I told him. He says, you know, most of the world doesn't believe that. And I said, yeah, but that doesn't make it not true. It just means most of the world doesn't believe it. So if we fail to really discern before entering into marriage, we'll end up many couples, right? The other thing with this try before you buy, right, it leads to divorce. I believe the statistics are that 90% of the couples who divorce, 90% of them cohabitated before marriage. And so you create a pattern of behavior. So I'm not saying if you've entered into marriage after cohabitating, you're doomed to failure. I'm just saying that that kind of behavior makes it more likely.
The other issue is that sex is like glue or like a cord. And when you are having sex before you've discerned that this is a person you're going to marry and you've actually walked to the altar with them, it's like putting on a blindfold. You can't see anymore. You can't make a good judgment because sex does this unitive thing. And so you get attached, even if you might come to realize later that you've attached yourself to a desk.
Well, in some states, you can marry a desk now.
I can marry the Eiffel Tower, too. Did you see that lady? You married the Eiffel Tower in a small ceremony with a few of her close relatives.
You ever see, like, that guy with, like, that Daryl, or that girl with that guy, and you're like, why are they even together?
This is one of the reasons why the church says no sex before marriage. Not because we're super prudish and we don't like sex because, I mean, I have 10 kids. but the issue is that if you hop into bed with somebody, you no longer have the ability to make a judgment about their character, their morality, whether or not this is a someone that you could live with happily and in a holy manner. Is this someone who's going to get you to heaven? I mean, you don't know. But you sure get wrapped up. So
are you saying that people shouldn't go dating?
No. In fact, instead of dating, we have an alternative. And it's called courting. So, courting versus dating. David, what do you think? Courting versus dating. What are some of the things? What is dating versus what courting is? What is your...
So to me, dating is usually one-on-one.
Okay, one-to-one.
And usually more, I would say, along the line almost like physical, because you want to hold hands and stuff. Whereas,
okay.
Oh, am I supposed to answer a court interior or just with dating?
No, dating. Okay. Just give me dating ideas and then we'll go on to voting. How could these two be different? Are they different? Why is it that we encourage courting as opposed to dating?
All right. Courting? Anybody have any ideas about what this is?
Courting most of the time was more like in a group setting.
Group setting,
like
exactly.
Supervised, not supervised, or chaperone.
Yeah, exactly. Just because we all know that after midnight, nothing good happens, right? Exactly. And we also, if you, has anyone here seen When Harry Met Sally? I mean, I know that was a long time. It was like from 1983.
I've seen that one.
The premise is that men and women don't make really good friends because there's always this sex thing that comes into the equation there. So the whole bit about a group is really important if you're trying to maintain your virtue and make sure that you know. In a public setting. Yeah, right, exactly.
I've been Navy for 15 years. So don't talk to me about mixed crews on submarines or mixed crews.
Also, this is more of a gathering together, getting to know the person in the context of family and friends until you can answer two questions. Number one, can I live happily with this person? Like, can we make it for 40 years? And can I live in a holy way with this person? Is this person actually going to help me get to heaven? Am I going to be able to help them get to heaven? Or is this just about, like, the money and the prenuptial agreement and the Mercedes and the house in the Bahamas? Things to ask yourself.
By the way, prenups are one of those things that will cause you problems if you want to get married in the church. Just saying. It's on our checklist of things where we sit a couple down and say, okay, you do know that you can't proceed if you have a prenuptial agreement. Right, because that means you're planning for the marriage to fail.
Yeah.
Right? So the escape valve. So anyway, back
escape clause. This seems relatively obvious, but I feel like I need to say it. Part of courting is making sure that the other person is actually available to get married. We can do a lot with dating websites and stuff. They've already culled out a lot of people. You can narrow it down to the person that looks best, fits your profile best. But you sometimes need to ask right out, are you married? The reason I say this is because we have a friend who just spent an inordinate amount of time with someone, developing a relationship with someone who was not wearing a wedding ring. And, oh, neglected to mention that he was already married. And although he was separated from his wife, hence not wearing the wedding ring, he didn't tell her that these five-hour-long conversations and trips to the gym together and trips to his home city were useless because he wasn't free to get married. So before you waste your time, as part of your discernment process, I encourage you to ask as well, are you available to be married? Do you have annulments? Do you have, if you've been previously married, is there anything that would stand in the way of making you good marriage material? And the other part of this is that in a lot of the world, there is such thing as arranged marriages. And we go, ooh, that really offends our independent American spirit. But the thing is, your friends and your family know you pretty well. And they're able to see you a little bit more clearly than you can see yourself sometimes. So relying on the input of friends, neighbors, family, if they're good ones, is really important. These people are all going to be a part of your marriage as well. So it would help if they had a chance to weigh in at least.
And meeting their family, letting their family meet yours. Yeah, it's important. Because it's really two families that are coming together. This idea of like the nuclear household is actually kind of industrial revolution stuff. Right? Traditional cultures, the family is this extended reality. And it's a much healthier way to live. So let the extended families get to know each other before you make that decision.
So fast forward a little ways past the compatibility issue. We were in a park in San Diego. And we were just, you know, hanging out. And suddenly, I just had this sense of peace that this was where I was supposed to be with him. That there was a sense of God saying, yes, this is where you're supposed to go. This is what you're supposed to do. And that came about as a result of us doing a lot of prayer over the whole issue of whether or not we should get married. So I encourage you, once you're courting someone, discerning marriage with them, pray together as a couple, and God will give you the sense of peace that you need in order to know you're going forward in the right place.
How long should one court?
Well, you know, actually, what's so interesting is that it's probably not that long at all. You just want to be able to answer those two questions. Can I live happily with this person? Can I live in a holy way with this person? If you drag it out, then you've got the whole issue of the whole sex thing comes up. And so why extend it for a long time if you know for sure that this is the right person? Many times people say, well, I'll get married when I buy my car, or I'll get married when I pay off my student loans, or I'll get married when I get a job. You know, I have the responsible thing to do is to make sure that I have enough money to be able to take care of my wife and children. Well, it's true that we have to be responsible and thoughtful about these things, but it's also true that God takes care of us and always provides what we need. We've had some pretty lean times, but we've never gone hungry. We haven't always gotten the things that we wanted, but we've always had the things we need. And that's God's job. He's our dad. He takes care of us. So rather than putting the brakes on for a long time, it's better to discern a person, find the one, a one, and marry them. And that brings up another issue. You have Mr. Right or Mrs. Right versus Mrs. or Mr. This is good enough. She may not be perfect, but neither are you.
You probably heard the joke, if there is a perfect person out there, why would they marry you, right?
So instead of taking a lot of time waiting for Mr. Right to come along while your biological clock ticks, go ahead, find someone who will do. It doesn't have to be perfect. But if you go through the steps of discernment and court and get the input of your priest and your friends and your relatives and whatnot, that should be adequate to find someone with whom you can live happily and holily.
Who's the next person to read, and would you give this to them? From that ink mark to the end of the paragraph. And just a comment on what Sylvia was saying. Like one of the things I see in pastoral ministry, couples who get married late.
Yes.
When you're in your late 20s and early 30s, you've had all this time you've lived by yourself. And now you're now living with someone else, and you've got all these habits, and they have all their habits. It can make it more difficult. We got married pretty much right out of college. And we've grown up together in that sense, and I think it can help. Anyway, our next reader.
So it's blue one, right?
Yes, sir. Yep. That blue ink mark. I like the mark of my books.
For a dating couple, frequent confession and holy communion are the basic safeguards against chosen of God. The best guarantee against tarnishing the beauty and holiness of matrimony by premarital liberties to which the couple have no right. The couple who seeks a truly happy marriage will come to the altar secure in the knowledge that they have kept their desire for each other under the control of reason and grace. Only when they have effected their partnership with God in marriage will they seek that oneness in flesh, which can be so noble an act when it's part of God's creative plan and so irrelevant. I'm sorry, I don't even know what that word is. Irreverent.
Irreverent.
The defiance of God when it's flesh against his will.
Yeah, so it's talking about basically intercourse outside of marriage. So thank you for reading that. So it talks, that paragraph really talks about the importance of the sacraments as a courting couple. So if you are serious about someone, you really should be going to confession together, you should be going to Mass together, and building that pattern so that if this is the person you're discerning to marry, that pattern continues, right? It's really important for couples to frequent confession. It's important for couples, obviously, to go to Mass on Sundays and feast days, if not daily together.
But only before you get married, right?
Oh, no. Especially after you get married, and especially when kids come along. I don't have anything to confess. Just wait. Just wait. So, and if I could have a go ahead.
You're in 69.
In his mercy, God has not forsaken sinful man. The punishment consequent upon sin, pain and childbearing, and toil and the sweat of your brow, also embody remedies that limit the damaging effects of sin. After the fall, marriage helps to overcome self-absorption, egoism, pursuit of one's own pleasure, and to open oneself to the other, to mutual aid, and to self-giving.
So you've probably seen at least one meme about the woman with one baby here and stirring a pot and another toddler grabbing here and the phone ringing and the husband's over there playing video games. Right? So this whole thing about learning to overcome your own egoism and your own self-absorption,
this thing happened. Oh, this is. I see.
I love their video games.
But no kids yet.
No kids yet. It's coming. It's coming. You got to learn how to change a diaper.
All right, with the controller. Yeah,
that's right.
One hand is called
Paul. The little chair thing.
Bolstering up the bottle while the football game. Marriage will give you a chance to overcome all of those addictive and self-absorbed behaviors.
Yes, absolutely. Because we're pretty much, I mean, we're inherently selfish. We're like little kids, right? For little kids, the world revolves around them. Some guy designs it. But marriage forces you out of yourself. And what we discover in marriage when we're forced out of ourselves is that we find that joy that we thought we would only find in being selfish, right? And doing our own thing. Factoid, right? The United States is one of the most wealthy countries in the world, yet we have one of the highest suicide rates. And we have the greatest instance of loneliness. Right? Those go together. So this whole idea of entering into communion with another human being, giving of yourself and being in relationship with them is a big part of what marriage teaches us, right? That's what it means to live as an authentic Christian. And if someone could read paragraphs, did you want
Christian
to read
House.
Now or no?
Yeah, read 16, what was it,
16, 14? Yeah. In his preaching, Jesus unequivocally taught the original meaning of the union of man and woman as the Creator willed it from the beginning. Permission given by Moses to divorce one's wife was a concession to the hardness of hearts. The matrimonial union of man and woman is indissoluble. God himself has determined it. What therefore God has joined together, let no man put asunder.
So, why did Moses allow for divorce?
So, basically, he gave them an out so that husbands in the Old Testament wouldn't kill their wives so that they could get married. Right.
That's really what
the Lord means by the hardness of your heart. It's a concession. But in the beginning, it was not so. So this is why the Catholic Church teaches, hey, divorce is not something that is really part of how we understand marriage. Now, from a pastoral perspective, we understand that marriages break down. We understand that things happen. But when you're trying to understand how we envision marriage within the church, you envision it as this lifelong commitment.
What does the word indissoluble mean?
Cannot be taken apart.
Cannot be, well, and dissolve is in there. So it can't come apart. So I'd like to use the analogy of a child, you know, a piece from the mom, a piece from the dad. Together, they make a whole child, and we can no more dissolve a marriage than we can split the DNA of the child back into two parts. All father DNA go to the left, all mother DNA go to the right. It doesn't work like that. And so that's our analogy for marriage being indissoluble. Okay. All righty. Moving right along.
We can skip Matthew 19, 1 through 12.
Okay.
We can talk about that. 1641? Do you want to go 1641
next?
I think, you actually have to draw something. So, I can pick that when you draw. Do you want to tell me that?
No, I think we can skip that.
Okay, who's going to be the next person?
I think Ken is next.
I'll note this page was missing, or
before
I
took it. Before you took it, so he said.
For the record.
Are you an attorney by chance? Oh, are you really?
Yeah.
We actually have a couple of attorneys in our parish, so I don't make lawyer jokes anymore. So.
Okay. I'm on it. I don't take myself too seriously. Which paragraph was it again?
41.
Okay. By reason of their state in life and of their order, Christian spouses have their own special gifts in the people of God. This grace proper to the sacrament of matrimony is intended to perfect the couple's love and to strengthen their indissoluble unity. By this grace, they help one another to attain holiness in their married life and in welcoming and educating their children.
So, just a couple of things really quickly. Their state in life and their order. So, married couples, actually, marriage is a vocation within the church, right? So we have recognized that the same way there are people who are called to the diaconate, to the priesthood, married people are, in a sense, ordained to serve the church. by reason of their marriage, by procreating, right, having children, by giving witness to Christian love, by filling the church with the next generation of Christians, right? So never think of being married as like, you know, a second-class state, right? Because as I like to say, the ordained ministry exists for the sake of those who are not ordained, so that you all can go out and preach the gospel to the world outside and meet people that, you know, priests and deacons will never encounter.
What is grace? You were talking about grace being necessary as part of holding all of these marriages together. What is grace?
It's like God's ability to forgive or give you power, I guess.
In a way. Do you want to give us the...
Unmerited favor.
Who said that? Said, it's unmerited favor. Can you translate
I'm glad he said it, because I would have had to Google it real quick.
It's not something we earn. It's something that God gives us.
Okay. Is anyone here too young to remember this? What's that? Pac-Man, exactly. So Pac-Man goes along, and he's chasing these little ghosts, and he gets to the corner, and there's this power pellet, right? So he eats the power pellet, and what happens?
The ghosts turn white and blue.
The whole screen turns blue and starts to flash, right? And then he can run really fast and eat the ghosts, where he had to run away from them before. So I like to use this as an analogy for sacraments, because they give us grace. This grace is like a power pellet. We get power that we don't have, that we didn't earn, that's just a gift from God who knows we need it, to allow us to do all the things that are hard and ongoing, lifelong.
And another way to think about grace, right, is God's own life within you. So God, like St. Paul, it may be in Romans or Galatians, I don't remember, maybe Ephesians, but he talks about it's God who is working in you to will and to do. Right, it's God working in you. So part of the Christian life is getting out of God's way by removing the obstacles, like our own selfishness, so that he can act in you. So when it talks about perfecting the love of the couple, this idea of perfection means completion, reaching its telos, its end. Right, so our love is meant to be like the love of Christ, which is completely self-sacrificial. Without the help of God's grace, it is impossible to love your spouse in a self-sacrificial way. Day in, day out, changing diapers, tending to them if they are sick, right? Giving up your will so that they, you know, so that you are working together instead of just me. But when you open yourself to God's help, God's grace, God's power in your life, it's something that you can achieve with God's help, thus frequenting the sacraments throughout your marriage. Sorry.
Good. All right. So we got married, and I was Protestant. And I had to sign that paper that said I would raise my children Catholic. I thought that was a lot of nerve, that they could tell me what I had to do with my... So I went to God and I said, I'm so sorry if I'm offending you, but I really want us to be unified in our marriage, and I don't want to go to the non-denominational service on Sunday morning and the Saturday evening mass on Saturday nights, you know, it's just divisive, and then we got to figure out where the kids are going to go and all that stuff. So forgive me for everything I do that's wrong, including signing this paper saying that I will raise my children Catholic, but I'm going to do it for the sake of unity. And so I did. What I also didn't realize was that the church had this other enormous teaching that I'd never heard of before. See, because where I came from, you didn't get married without birth control. I mean, but who does that? You have to have time together so that you can grow as a couple, you can make your nest egg, you can buy your car and pay off your student loans and buy your house. You don't just have children. I mean, that's like so West Virginia. We had a friend at the Naval Academy from West Virginia. This is very much aside. And he used to say that the reason that he really liked to be in the Navy was it was the first time he'd ever owned more than one pair of shoes. Anyway, well, he could have been. So the thing was...
Before you jump in, did you want that paragraph or no?
No.
Okay.
Because we already talked about it.
You got it.
So, what to do about this thing? Because I don't have a baby right away. I mean, I was like 21, 22 somewhere. I was 21 when I was just barely. I was about to be 21 when we got married. So, you know, it was a thing. So we did the contraceptive thing because what else was there to do? I mean, I've never heard of anybody. Like, where in the Baptist church or the Methodist church do they teach that you should not use contraception? I mean, that's the responsible thing to do. So we were contracepting.
Anyone here know who Hank Pettigraf is? The Bible Answer Man?
He was a radio program back in the day when you were like two.
I mean, now he's Greek Orthodox, which is kind of funny. But the Bible Answer Man was this call-in radio show, so I'd be driving home from the ship every day listening, right? And I would really enjoy it when he was going after the Mormons and the Jehovah's Witnesses. And every now and then he'd go after the Catholics, so I'd turn it down. You know, get really angry. But then, like, I'm driving home, right, and this lady, a little lady in a probably 12-passenger van, and she asked him a question, right? Now, Hank Pettigraf is one of the most erudite speakers you will ever hear. Extremely polished. It's amazing. And she says, tell me where in the Bible it says contraception's okay. And this guy, right, he would, like, just took people down left, right, and center, starts hemming and hawing, right? And I have a dark complexion, but I was blushing, right? And I started to sweat, and I felt the heat rising. And in the conversation, like, she won. He couldn't give her a conclusive answer. So I get home, and I say, we need to have a talk. And to quote Scott Hahn, our theology brought a change, about a change in my wife's physiology.
But that change did not come until we did something super important, and that was to read a source document. So you know the importance of source documents. The thing was, I was just kind of anti-Catholic because, you know, it's just, you know, if you come up in a Protestant church, it's just sort of, you know, it's not nice to be Catholic. So I had never read a source document of the church before, but I knew it wasn't nice because that's the culture. So then we picked up this book.
Very thin.
A very thin book, and it had this Latin title.
Scott's going to give you a copy.
Scott?
Yes, I messed up, and I don't have the copies tonight, but you will get a copy within the next 2 weeks.
Of course, you could also look it up on your phone and read it. It's called Humana Vitae. It's on human life, and it was written by a pope in the 1960s. Now, here's the situation in the 1960s, which you might remember from your history books. Things were a little crazy. And at the time, birth control as a mass market thing was just coming to the market. And everyone was saying to Catholics, don't worry, the pope is about to say it's okay to use artificial birth control. Don't worry, just go ahead and use it because he's about to say that it's all right. And then, in the late 1960s, the Pope did make a statement. But he did not say that it was all right to use birth control. In fact, he says, if you use artificial birth control, five things are going to happen. Not just in your life, but in society. I have a list to make sure I get them all. Number one, there is going to be a loss of respect for women. A woman will begin to be seen as a thing, just to be used for other people's sexual pleasure, available at any time. That was number one. Number two, he said, governments are going to impose sterilization. Oh, we've never heard of that before, have we? It only took 11 years after he wrote this encyclical for China to institute their one-child policy. 11 years later. He said, there will be an increase in conjugal infidelity. And what do you know? There's actually statistics to back up that any man who thinks he's infertile is hugely more likely to be unfaithful to his wife. No consequences, right? Number four was, there will be a general lowering of morality. We've seen a general lowering of morality since the 1960s. And number five is that women will be in poverty, mainly because they're single moms with children. No one to protect or defend them. Or they're forced to abort their children, which leads to all kinds of emotional upheaval for both the mom and the dad. So anyway, we read this Humana Vitae, and I remember we were driving across the country,
And I was the one getting hot and sweating while we read this, because I recognized the truth with a capital T. Spoke to me right here. First time I'd ever bothered to read a source document from the church and find out what the church actually said, not just what another person who hated the church said about the church. And when I recognized that truth as a capital T, we threw out our stuff, and it wasn't long before Mary was on the way. So Mary was the first of our 8 birth children and 2 adopted children. So we have a total of 10. So I had to do a little bit more research into this, because I'll tell you how much hard work is happening right here. It is hard to be pregnant. And then what's even harder is to be pregnant when you have a toddler, or 2 toddlers, or 3, or 4. So about the time when we had 4 children who were 5 and under, having adopted 2 that matched our birth children, I needed a little bit of time in between babies to let some of these grow up a little bit. So we did some research into this thing called natural family planning.
Isn't that the rhythm method? People who use that are called parents.
People who use the rhythm method are called parents, that's right. It is actually... It started as the rhythm method, but the rhythm method doesn't work. The rhythm method says, if you count 2 weeks from the first day of your period, and I say your, but you understand I'm not... So, about 2 weeks from the first day of your period is when you ovulate. And for some women, that is absolutely spot on, right, true. But that's like 2% of the population. So, for the rest of us, 2 weeks is all over the map and might not have anything to do at all with your ovulations. So that's why rhythm method users were considered parents. However, as time went by, science kicked in. And people began to study, well, okay, so how can we really put a space in there so that if mentally you've had enough for a minute, and for a hot minute you need a little break while these kids go from 0 to 3 or, you know, whatever it is, how can we do that for women without injecting with them with something that hurts them or breaks their immune system, without putting a physical barrier between yourself and your spouse, because you say, oh, honey, I love you so much, before we have sex, let me gear up for battle. Let me put on like something that will kill the parts of you that come into me. So it's kind of like lying with your behavior.
Much for the total gift of self.
Total gift of self, not, yeah, exactly. So what can we do about this? So along comes natural family planning. So natural family planning allows you, without breaking yourself or injecting yourself or taking a pill, which, by the way, causes cancer at the same rate as asbestos. We don't have asbestos in our house, but women for 10, 15 years in a row, every day, will take a pill that breaks their immune system, destroys their hormones, reduces their libido to almost nothing, and makes them gain weight. I mean, what guy doesn't want that, right? Let's also remember the irritability part that comes with that, too. And I know that every guy wants to live with a woman for 15 years who has no interest in him sexually and is overweight and overwhelmed and likely to develop cancer at some time in their life.
So, are you going to write these things on the board?
Well, if I give you the marker, will you write?
I was going to ask one to read 1652.
Oh, see, but I'm still talking.
All right.
There you go. Okay, so we learned how to do natural family planning, which involves some work. I mean, it's not just super easy. But what we found out is that despite the more than 50% divorce rate in our society, if a couple does any form of natural family planning, and there are like 25 different forms now, that divorce rate goes down to 2%. If that's not divorce-proofing your marriage, I have no other definition for divorce-proofing your marriage. From more than 50% to 2%, that's amazing. Now, does it work? It works about as well as every other kind of birth control, artificial birth control on the market. It has a very high rating in laboratory settings, 99.5% effective at preventing a pregnancy. Of course, by the time you get it home, it's like the condom that's been in your wallet for 2 years and, you know, it's got a hole in it. That's how well it goes down to about 96%. But natural family planning is as effective as any form of artificial birth control, including, get this, sterilization
has a 2% failure rate over 10 years. And did you know if a man gets sterilized within 1 year, he has a 40% chance of developing a personality disorder? All these angry young men running around? Well, there might be a reason for it. So, doing this naturally and not breaking yourself or your husband in order to accomplish this allows you to put some space in between babies in case you need it. Because some women get overwhelmed when there's a lot of little people to take care of. We need grace, we need the protection and the support of our husbands, but sometimes we also need a little space. So we take that space when we need it. Now, we have at least one child that we could name total lack of self-control, because the object of natural family planning is you have intercourse when you're fertile if you want to get pregnant. And if you want to avoid a pregnancy for a certain amount of time, then you have intercourse when you're not fertile. And those are the very adult means of making this work. It means there are no taking chances. It means that you have to be on top of where you are in your cycle. And that happens through making daily observations and just knowing where you are in your cycle. But in the end, you have a family of children that know that they came into your family because God wanted them there. That's a beautiful thing. All right. Oh, I wanted to talk about this one down here too. So, of course, that means if you're trying to avoid a pregnancy, there are going to be some times during the woman's cycle where you have to avoid intercourse if you're not going to conceive. And that is very hard for people to imagine, because if you watch network television, it's not about exercising self-control. So this idea of a rhythm of when the woman is available and when she's not available based on your family planning needs is completely foreign. So I've now taught NFP for, I don't know, 13, going on 14 years. And what I found, one woman in particular said it this way. She said, "I was so upset when I first started doing this natural family planning, because at the beginning we ask for one full cycle with no genital contact, so we know what your body does without any of the liquids that come along with intercourse." So she said, and we waited that full month. We waited that whole cycle. And when we came back together again, it was like we were virgins. Because in their marriage, sex was something that they did at 7 o'clock on Tuesday nights. It was an appointment. It was a business interchange. There was nothing more about themselves in it. But when you took away the always available all the time, then suddenly it was like they were virgins again. And there was this joy and this peace that came from coming together again as a couple. So, is NFP difficult? It can be. But is it worth it? Absolutely.
Maybe I'm showing my age, but who are these married people who are having sex with each other all the time?
See, right? Okay.
Like, what the hell?
I know, who's got time for that?
This is like so hard for me to find. Like, what are you, like, met yesterday? You guys are having sex with each other? Like,
you know, it's a thing.
It's the last 4 years of my marriage, next, like, I think they had sex 3 times.
Right, because you had little ones, right? You have a 9-year-old son?
I have a 9-year-old, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just like so far, like, who are these married people having sex regularly?
Are you kidding me? This is actually part of an authentic application of marriage. Right? Because the NFP forces us to have a conversation.
On a regular basis. Like, is this a night or is this not a night?
But right, and it also, as part of what she teaches...
I'm glad you got such a good laugh out of that.
I just like the candidness.
Yeah.
I'm an open book.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, people mistakenly believe that the Catholic Church is, like, really down on sex and that sex is dirty and unclean. That's, like, Puritan talk. It is. Right? But an authentic Catholic view of the human person, sex is not only good, it's holy.
It's holy.
But it's meant to be used within the context of marriage.
And we've got these two great words. Sex is for two purposes. Creative. And this is where that cord came into play. It's unitive. It draws you together. If you're going to make it in this world, you've got to have something that, like, pulls you together and sticks you there. That's why if you're repeatedly having sex with multiple different partners, the sticky part of the sticking together
gets less sticky. So eventually, you don't stick with the partner that you've had. So if you had multiple partners before you get married, it's going to be really hard to make the unitive part of sex work when you get married. The other part is the procreative. And the issue with artificial birth control is that it breaks this right here. It might allow the unitive, but it doesn't allow the procreative. And you can say, well, you know, natural family planning, you're kind of not choosing not to procreate either. But it allows God to still say, I'm going to do something here. And sometimes he does. So it also keeps you from getting cancer and dying or getting your immune system breaking apart because of the things that you've put into your body. Interesting. Side note, very side note. They came up with a male birth control pill before the female birth control pill came on the market, and one of the guys in the test group, he got a headache. They whipped that thing off the market so fast, heads were flying. And then they came up with a female birth control pill, and a woman died in the trials. And they said, oh, this looks like a great thing to mass market. Anywho, I digress.
So I think we're going to sort of close down on this. I mean, this is a really important part of the church teaching. Sometimes people kind of look at this and say, yeah, you don't really believe that, do you? This teaching that has seemed to be revolutionary by the Catholic Church is a teaching that no Christian group ever discussed, debated, or thought twice about until about 1918.
1928,
yeah. Thank you. I was off by 11
years. 10 years. Yeah.
So it's not revolutionary. It's simply that the Catholic Church has maintained this teaching consistently. And there are plenty of writings from the Church Fathers, right? Because the ancients knew about contraception and they knew about abortion.
Yeah.
Right? So these teachings that the Church holds to today, the two teachings are related. Because oftentimes abortion is used as emergency contraception. And so it's important to, in your marriage and if you're teaching, you're talking to other people, and if you're single, to really be aware of this and to do the best you can to try to achieve this vision in your marriage. So as I said at the beginning of the talk, right, if there are struggles with this, make sure you talk to your pastor, sit down, have a conversation. The important thing isn't to make the decision on your own. The Catholic Church does not teach that you have to have as many kids as you should. Yes,
and
my wife teaches an FP. Yes, we have
10.
But the Church teaches responsible parenthood. And what that looks like is different for every couple. It teaches responsible parenthood. So just like getting married, it's discernment. So each couple has to figure this out with their pastor, you know, with each other. So,
you
want to
talk about domestic church?
Yes, actually. Can I have someone read paragraph 1655?
He's got it. James is up. And I feel just pass it over.
I'm going to get suspicious if there's another porn page there. What's going on over there?
Redaction is underway.
1655, please.
Christ chose to be born and grow up in the bosom of the Holy Family of Joseph and Mary. The Church is nothing other than the family of God. From the beginning, the core of the Church was often constituted by those who have become believers together with all their household. When they were converted, they desired that their whole household should also be saved. These families who became believers were islands of Christian life in an unbelieving world.
So, clearly what we just talked about, right, NFP versus contraception is very, like, counter-cultural. The idea of praying with your children in the home, or reading the Bible, or imparting your religious beliefs to your children, that's also pretty revolutionary. But from the earliest times, the home was known as the domestic church, right? The little church. So what we do together, the communal worship, right? When we come to Mass, that kind of thing, that's meant to sort of continue in a way in the home. So the home should be a school for prayer. The home should be a school of Christian virtue. And so we learn to do these things. So part of Catholic marriage is understanding that our life as Christians isn't just on Sundays, and the Mass, it's an entire lifestyle that we take on and that we live in church, we live in the workplace, we live at home, morning prayer, evening prayer, the feast days, that kind of thing. There was something else, but I completely forgot what it was. So Over to you. Yeah.
Well, so you talked about two important parts of the domestic church. And I want to kind of put it in practical terms.
Please.
So what it means is you have these kids in your house. And you want to raise them up with a faith already in place. Because there's no sense in sending them off to some of the most tumultuous and difficult times of your life, known as high school, without any moral compass, so that they don't know what to do or what to think. And many people say, well, I'm going to let my children decide what faith they want to belong to, or if they want a faith at all, when they get to the age where they can decide that. But when you do that, you uncover them and expose them to every influence that the world has to offer, and there are many. And you give them no ability to discern between what is right and what is wrong, and therefore make good choices. So we say, go off, go your way and make good choices. But if we don't give them a framework to discern which choices are good and bad, we're not doing our job as parents. So the church has Sunday school or CCD to teach our children. But really the onus and the responsibility for teaching our children falls on us as parents. It's the church saying, here, let me help you. In case you don't know everything that you need to teach your children, let me help you. But unless they're doing it at home, unless you guys are gathering together to pray before they go to bed, or gathering around the dinner table and saying grace where dad leads the grace, it's not going to work as well. There's another statistic that talks about unless the dad is actively involved in the religion, the children will never go to church once they become adults, even if mom is super faithful. They need to see the example of the dad going to church and praying with the family on a regular basis. So when our kids were little, we did a rosary, and it was more like a jungle gymery because, you know, they're all over, and I don't know a four-year-old boy who can sit while you pray the rosary. So, you know, we'd grab them, or we'd use it as a time to scratch their head while we pray the rosary, or, you know, just sit together, and we'd put little pictures up so they could see what it was we were praying about and talking about and meditating on. And it wasn't always great, by a long shot. But they got the idea that there's this time when we get together as a group and we come to God and we tell him, we say, okay, now what are you thankful for? What are you grateful for? And what would you like to pray for? And so we all go around and talk about the things that we're grateful for, we want to pray for. And that gives the children this idea that we as a group take care of other people by lifting up their needs as well. So this is, it's in the home setting, around your dinner table, at bedtime prayer, at morning prayer when you wake up, praying over lunch. Anytime you have the opportunity to approach God as a group and as a family, you're teaching them how to come to church, how to approach God, how to find the grace to help in time of need, says the scriptures. That's all on us as parents. Huge responsibility.
If I could get someone to read paragraphs 16 to 57, and I'll ask you to pass it that way, just to give you time.
Is it 1657?
Yes, please.
Length of age.
And a quick comment, too. Like, if you're unmarried, or if you're not able to have children, right? So that's, we're not saying that you're not a real Christian family, that it's not a real marriage if you don't have children. What we're pointing to is the communal nature of Christian marriage. So even those couples who don't have children can still exercise spiritual fatherhood and spiritual motherhood, either through adopting, through inviting people into the home, through giving themselves to the community in other ways. So there are different ways to be fruitful if you aren't able to have children. So I wanted to throw that out there.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. 1657, when you're ready.
It is here that the father of the family, the mother, children, and all members of the family exercise the priesthood of the baptized in a privileged way. By the reception of the sacraments, prayer, and thanksgiving, the witness of a holy life and self-denial and act of charity, thus the home is the first school of Christian life and a school for human enrichment. Here one learns endurance and the joy of work, fraternal love, generous, even repeated, forgiveness, and above all, divine worship and prayer and offerings of one's life.
Thank you. So, it's part of the teaching of the church, right, that by virtue of your baptism, you share in the ministry of Christ as priest, prophet, and king, right? Priests offer sacrifices.
right? The priesthood of the baptized, you offer the sacrifice of yourself for the sake of others, the sacrifice of praise, right? Prophet, you speak. Prophets don't tell the future; they speak on behalf of God. They teach, so you learn the faith so that you can share it with others in society. And king, right? Or queen, right? Lordship, dominion. We learn to rule over our passions, and we learn to put the world in order for the sake of God. That means that we can't just sort of leave our faith at the door when we step outside, that we exercise our faith to the extent we can within the public arena. So this is all to say that Christian marriage is something that shapes you, it forms you, it shapes your children. If you have them, it forms you. And it's meant to be leaven in the entire world. So the Christian household is meant to be this beacon of light, right, in the darkness. And so you are raising, if you're raising children, you're raising them as apostles, as martyrs, witnesses to Christ, and as disciples. But you yourselves have to be that first. So.
Good. Questions?
I think we have are
okay.
Well, 6 minutes is fair.
Got 6 minutes worth of questions. Give us a good one.
What you guys learned in RCIA? We talked about sex! What?
What is that? You were saying earlier that when you were Protestant and you got married that you signed a letter saying, so when was it, or how long was it when you were married until that before you went to being Catholic? And what did the I guess when you sat down with like one of the fathers and you talked about like what was their I guess feedback about you all being two different phases of the Christian relationship?
Right, well, first of all, we eloped, which I highly recommend to anybody.
And then later had our marriage convalidated.
Great. Yes, that was the other part of it. Really good question, very insightful. Clearly, these are issues you're dealing with as well.
Yes.
So I went to the priest, Irish priest, and said, who is this woman who calls herself the mother of God and therefore implies that she came before God? Because, you know, in the Protestant church especially, we're very, very reverent about God being the Father. Period. Full stop. Ain't nobody else. So when I first walked up to the front of that church where the lady was talking in the microphone and I found out she was the mother of the church, I went, mother of the church? Because then I found out that Solomon, King Solomon, David's son, he set up a throne in his throne room for his mother. She was called the Gibeah. And if you really wanted something done, you didn't go to the king. He might chop your head off. You went to the mom and you said, hey, mom, can you go to your son and get him to get this done for me? Okay, so I didn't know about any of that until later because, like I said, I had never read a source document. But when I found out about that and who Mary was, not this woman interloper who was like some priestess, goddess type of gross thing, I started to get a little nervous because if she is who the church says she is, then I've been ignoring her all my life. And she's done nothing but try to help me. So Elliot went out to sea. Well, when he was still in the yards, he would go to daily mass. So I would trudge up there with him because, you know, I didn't get a whole lot of time with him because he was always out to sea. So I would go to mass with him and that was nice. And when he went out to sea, I would still go to mass because it kind of reminded me of him. And I was lonely and I was alone on the other side of the country and it was hard. So then one day, the little old ladies at the front of the church who sit down and pray the rosary after the mass, they were like, honey, come on up here. We'll come pray the rosary with us. And I was like, whoa, back. And I thanked them politely. And then the next day they said it again and again. And finally I said, Lord, I'm sorry if I'm offended you, but I really want to be part of a community and I'm just going to say these prayers. And once Our Lady gets her hooks on you, there is no going back. And that was the end of it for me. When I started to pray the rosary and then meditate on the mysteries of the rosary, which are all about the mysteries of Christ's life and Our Lady's life,
I sort of entered into a relationship with her and with Jesus that I had never had as a Protestant, and it was much more about being a family, which I craved. I wanted that connectedness so badly, especially since he was gone. So then one day he came back. I'm like, well, I guess I should probably become Catholic. And he's like, oh, okay. So then I called home to tell my Protestant family. And I know you can appreciate this because you've done the same thing. So I called them up to say, in the interest of the unity of our marriage, I have decided that I'm going to enter fully into the Catholic faith, you know, and waited for the onslaught. And there was a pause, and then, well, I'm not surprised you're becoming Catholic because you were baptized Catholic when you were two. Come again. So that's when I learned about the sacraments. Because apparently when you get the sacrament, you get this grace. And the grace reels you back in. So all those years later, there I was back in the arms of the Catholic Church. So the sacraments are real and powerful. Our Lady is a real person, and she has a real purpose, and it's not to take the glory away from God. News to me. And after I had those things worked out, then pretty much everything fell into place, because then we read Humanae Vitae, and I recognized the truth with a capital T. It was gut-level truth, and I went, eh. So then we really tried to organize our life or orient it properly in front of God and in the community. And things got better after that. So.
Obviously, you were Catholic. And then you went with the Melkite.
Correct.
You were Roman Catholic.
How did that spot happen?
We were Roman Catholics in the 90s of San Diego. And that's a scary place to be, a scary time to be, if you wanted, like, to go to Mass, and, like, it was really Mass. First time we ever walked out of a church, the opening prayer is, Father and Mother God. We looked at each other, and we're like, we're out of here. So, long story short, after a series of unfortunate liturgical events, we found ourselves at a Byzantine church. It was a Ruthenian church, and the Ruthenians are Eastern Christians in union with Rome. And I left.
Come out of Eastern Europe.
Eastern Europe. And we fell in love. The entire liturgy was sung. There were icons from floor to ceiling. There was incense. And I just remember going like, this is what I'm looking for, right? It struck a chord in my heart. Now we moved with the Navy, found a similar church that was only 1 hour away. We had, because of adoption, we'd gone from two kids to four kids in 6 months. So we got in our car, drove an hour, had a very beautiful liturgy, drove an hour back, looked at each other and said, uh-uh. So as long as we were in the Navy, we continued to sojourn with the Roman Catholic Church. That's how we ended up here at St. Veronica, because it had good liturgy, good teaching. Yeah. When I got out of the Navy, and we moved far away from St. Veronica's for a bit, and I started studying theology in Christendom, other questions began coming up for me. So I began to explore the Eastern Church again. And one day we drove 90 minutes to the Melkite Church, and I said, it's just to check it out. I'm not going to ask us to drive 90 minutes one way every Sunday. And after liturgy, she said, I don't know where you're going next Sunday, but we're all going to be here. And so that's the short version of the story. It was really God tugging at my heart through beauty. I found something in the Eastern Church that really spoke to me. So when I completed my theology degree, I presented myself to the bishop as a candidate for ordination. So that also involves something called the transfer of ascription. So canonically, I'm not a Roman Catholic. Canonically, I'm a Melkite Greek Catholic. When you're baptized into the Catholic communion, you're ascribed to a particular church. Mm-hmm.
So you moved yours from the Roman Church to the
Melkite Greek Catholic Church. Right. Okay. I have a lot of unusual entries on my baptismal certificate.
And if I can just add an aside, next week, he will, instead of just being... Father Elias, he will be Father Dr. Elias because he got Reverend Father Dr. Elias because he is being awarded his doctorate in ministry next Monday.
Congratulations.
Oh.
Thank you.
You do understand that it's a terminal degree and that means you're never going back to school again, right?
It's a terminal degree because if you try for another one, your wife will lose your terminal.
Terminate.
Yes. Anyway, that's how we did it.
Okay.
So, but our church, I mean, we're open. Any Roman Catholic can go to an Eastern Catholic church. You don't have to be an Eastern Catholic.
Yeah. We explored Eastern Orthodoxy as well. So we've gone everywhere.
Oh, so you've seen. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the liturgy is almost exactly the same, except that you, as a Roman Catholic, you can't receive at an Orthodox church, whereas if you come to an Eastern Catholic church, of course you can receive.
Right. Yeah. I mean, our self-identity is we are Orthodox Christians who exist in the communion of the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. Now, the Orthodox will look at us askance and say, well, we are not. But, so, Mass for us is a little bit different, but it's very beautiful. Mm-hmm.
That may be more than 6 minutes, but if anyone has any other questions,
any other questions? Well, then with the prayer.
Yeah, can I just share a couple of things to pray about? Brian Collies, who usually sits back here, is recovering from heart surgery. He's doing well, but he had a valve replacement and is dealing with all that fun. So please keep him in your prayers. And also, Father Kleinman's father passed away last week. So please pray for the repose of his soul and for the Kleinman family.
I'll get those names from the police now. Make sure we pray for the church as
well.
Good. All right. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God forever and ever.
Amen.
It is truly meet to bless you with Theotokos, who are ever blessed and all blameless, and the Mother of our God, higher and honored than the cherubim, who are truly more glorious beyond compare than the seraphim. You, who without stain did bear God the Word, you are truly Theotokos, you do we exalt. Through the prayers of our Holy Fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us.
Amen.
Thank you all. You were a wonderful audience.
Thank you. Thank you.